Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more. Eat me.
All right, you have tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the back of Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And I am your host today, Erin Fairbanks. This is a special studio recording. We are in studio today with some very special guests from Chicago. We are with Chef Eric Williams and Chef Zoe Shore. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you. So I'm excited because I've been like wanting to get more in touch with the Chicago scene. So I want to tuck into that a little later in the interview, but I thought we'd start by getting a better sense of who you are. And Zoe, maybe we'll start with you. Now, your history, you were like New York, LA, Chicago. So are you just like a wanderlust traveler? Tell us a little bit about your progression.
I mean, I like to move around. I left New York to go to Los Angeles. The decision was primarily weather-based, and it was one I definitely never regretted. But eventually that scene kind of wore itself out and Chicago called my name.
Yeah. Now you've worked for a lot of the big, you know, capital T chefs, Tom Keller, Tom Colicchio, Todd English. I'm curious if maybe you can tell us a little, you know, obviously as you moved to the kitchen, your kind of expertise, your positions in those kitchens changed. But I'm just curious if you could maybe give us some broad stroke highlights for each of those capital T gentlemen.
Yeah, definitely. Tom Colicchio was probably the most exciting because I decided to go to culinary school largely because of how much I loved Top Chef. And that first season of Top Chef really, really influenced me. And when I moved to Los Angeles, a couple weeks later, I found out they were opening Kraft there in Century City. And it was just sort of a no-brainer to go apply. But I had zero experience coming right out of a sort of all-natural culinary school and didn't really expect to get hired.
At a steak place.
What's that? Well, it wasn't Kraft Steak, so it's a little bit better. But yeah, they definitely made fun of me for my vegan culinary background. But I was just really lucky, I think, to get my foot in the door there. And working there was great, and working for Tom Colicchio was great. The kitchen was wonderful, and it was a great experience. And then, you know, that name opens a lot more doors for you to have worked for Tom Colicchio. And so my time under Todd English at Beso was probably my most formative time. I worked for my most influential chef who taught me just everything. I started out there on the Garde Manger station, worked my way through all the stations. When I was a sous chef there, and then I left to go work for Thomas Keller. And so that was probably, you know, the most exciting, interesting, informational place I worked.
Yeah, when you kind of made that decision, like, I'm really going to do this.
Yeah, exactly. It was definitely a make or break kind of a thing. And I definitely came very close to breaking a couple of times.
I broke. In my fourth year cooking, I was at Gramercy Tavern. I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Fourth year and you broke. Wow.
Yeah, well, I like to go deep. all right, so then you left that kitchen and you went to work under Tom, but then you were the chef for a while at the Dark Room. So I'm not super familiar with that. What's that spot? What kind of food were you doing there?
The Dark Room's actually a very, very cool kind of dive bar in Los Angeles, and they decided to put a kitchen in. It was a little bit unprecedented. It was, you know, PBR and bags of chips kind of a bar. And the kitchen, I mean, it's there, and they're still doing the same menu we were doing, but it wasn't quite as food-focused as we were hoping it was going to become. And when the opportunity came along to move to Chicago and work for Michael Cornick, who's always been, you know, a little bit of an idol for me, as well as, you know, almost part of the family because my best friends worked for him in Chicago, the opportunity was too good to pass up.
Sure. So now you are the chef at Ada Street.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And so tell us a little bit about what you got cooking over there. What's on the menu?
It's kind of like eclectic small plates with a little bit of an elevated Bar Bites menu. Obviously, Chef Cornick had a ton of influence going in, But the day-to-day menu is sort of changed and driven by me and my sous chef, who is just ridiculously awesome. So we try to do a lot of seasonal stuff. We try to change up the specials a lot, but we've got, you know, a lot of interesting twists on bar bites. We like to do a lot of seafood. He and I are both very seafood focused. So octopus, prawns, you know, mussels, clams. We've had some great mussels coming in from Maine all this month.
Nice, sounds pretty tasty. Now, Eric, have you always been in Chicago? Is that your?
Yes, I'm a native.
You're a native Chicago, and you're the chef over at MK, and you were part of the opening team there, right?
Yes.
So, what were you doing before you jumped on that ship?
Actually, I worked about 4 years in the culinary industry before I started with MK, and I wasn't as passionate about cooking originally. As I tell the story, Michael Cornick's passion is so strong that it really became infectious as I worked with him over the years. And it really kind of took me by storm. I mean, he's so engaged in food, and his passion essentially became my passion, and it's been a great ride.
So what were you doing when you started at the restaurant? Because you didn't start as the opening chef, obviously.
I literally started making salads at MK and worked my way through every station. And started running mornings a couple years after that as a sous chef, ran lunches. Once we stopped doing lunch, I moved to nights and took on more duties with the night staff. And then later went back to mornings again and did all the relationship, created some other relationships with vendors and headed up all the offsite catering. And then continue to grow in my capacity over the years, basically.
Cool. And then it was 2008 that you stepped in with like full reins for leadership in the kitchen. Is
yes.
that so? Now I know that the MK is known as kind of a farm to table restaurant, and you've worked closely, I'm assuming, in your AM time developing relationship with different farmers. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the farms you guys work with?
Sure. We work with farms by the name of Nichols Farms, Werp Farms. We also work with a couple of out-of-state farms by the name of Chef's Garden, Spence Farms, and a host of others. And the relationships have been very critical to our passion and our view to be able to put the freshest possible ingredients we can on the plate. And over the years, some of those relationships have gone beyond just a partnership, but friendships. Our farmers come in and they eat in the restaurant as much as possible. We've created the kind of energy that allows us to have growers grow the things specific to our needs, and we really try to utilize a lot of ingredients that are sometimes overlooked in soups and sauces and things like that and purees. You know, we've been conditioned to buy food based on what it looks like and not what it tastes like. So squash that is bruised in many cases won't get picked up at the farmer's market. And so we take those items, we're able to peel those, you know, those bruised areas off and utilize them. Ironically, I was just picking up persimmons the other day. We had a crazy weekend and there was need for me to pick up persimmons from like a local grocery store. And a woman's walking by me, and I'm touching every single persimmon in the grocery store. And she's like, there are better ones at the front door. And I said, I actually looked at those on the way in. And she said, well, why do you want these gnarly ones? And I said, actually, the skin I can't use. And she was just looking at the brown spots on the outer skin, which gets peeled away.
Yep.
But those were actually the ones that were the best, because the ones at the front door were bright orange.
Yeah,
and
you don't
hard
want
to
eat
as a
those.
Rock. Yeah, they were golf balls. You know, and that's just the perception of the average person that's, you know, shopping for food or trying to prepare a meal. They want what appears to be or what looks really great, but we try to delve beyond that and get food that's the sweetest, that contains the most moisture content, and of course, at the end of the day, the food that's delicious. So
it tastes the best. Yeah. Well, I think it's also nice for farmers, especially smaller scale producers, to have markets for the super pretty stuff, and then markets for, you know, I don't want to say seconds because I think that implies like a lower kind of grade, but often it is, I think, an aesthetic issue.
Yeah.
Now, so tell us a little bit about what you have on the menu right now. What are you guys serving? What are you excited about in this beautiful, as we head into February, the, I think, toughest time to be a cook in the northern regions of the country?
You know, as the tide tends to change in Chicago and the bitter winds blow a little harder, I think the things that we get the most excited about are deep braises. We have a delicious short rib dish on the menu right now with horseradish cream, Brussels sprouts, petite carrots, and fried shallots, which is a dish that I worked on with my sous chef, who's been a phenomenal asset to me over the years. And those are the things that we really get the most excited about. We have a tasting menu, which is five courses, which changes every 3 weeks, and that's where we really get the opportunity to display what's on the forefront of our minds. And as the diners come in, they kind of select which of those dishes are going to end up traveling from our tasting menu to the menu based on you know, their receiving of those dishes. And I mean, winter is probably the toughest month for us to cook, because unlike California, the space where my friend over here spent some of her time, you know, our farmers markets aren't growing much, and most of what they have is grains that are in storage, onions and potatoes. So we tend to lean on our desire to cook comfort food and really fancy it up and present it in a way that the people are pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I know. I always end up packing on a couple pounds in the winter. Lots of like starchy braises. I'm like a sucker for all of that. So you also do, Eric, you do a lot of work kind of teaching and training different
at risk.
Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, there's my Midwest drawl / lisp coming out. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in that work and what it looks like?
Sure. I grew up in a pretty tough area in Chicago's. In Chicago neighborhoods, and the community is called Lawndale, and it was tragically highlighted in the past couple of years because of the amount of violence that takes place in that neighborhood. And another neighborhood in the city that also receives that kind of negative publicity is Inglewood. And so I've worked with a number of groups in both areas, trying to create a platform for kids to really have an opportunity not to just learn knife skills, but to learn life skills. And I think one of the things that really impressed me about kitchens when I started working in the beginning was the fact that you could take, if you had the ability to listen, if you had the ability to think on your feet, and you had some knack for survival, so to speak, you could really pick up a clear grasp of what was going on in the kitchen. And afford yourself an opportunity not to just learn, but to take care of yourself. And those are skills that are applied in most jobs in a lot of instances. But sometimes there's a disconnect when kids are lack of education or underprivileged for whatever reason. You kind of find yourself in a situation where you don't know what applies to you. And I think that the cooking or the culinary profession is able to reach a lot of different groups on many different levels, many different social and economic scales, and give them an opportunity or a platform to really be able to exceed. And so I guess I've kind of become a voice for that movement, or a face behind that movement. And it's been very successful for me. And I get a lot of pride in the opportunity to work with kids and have them see that, despite what you see on television, the work is really hard and the days are really long, but there is a lot of gratification in taking a raw product and creating something with your hands.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of my favorite things about cooking, especially in the restaurant environment, is you get to measure your success or failure like almost immediately and repeatedly. Yeah. In like, I was when like on the line, I'm like 3 to 5 minute chunks. Over and over and over again. I'm like, am I good? Do I suck? Am I good? Do I suck?
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like when you go into kind of the first steps for working with some of these groups, what's the kind of, where do you start? Like, what's the first conversation?
The first conversation generally deals with safety, because it happens to be one of the most important things in kitchens, especially with someone that's foreign to using a knife, foreign to the traffic that takes place in restaurants and the speed of which everything takes place. Even in a slow kitchen, everything's happening pretty fast. So in a couple seconds, you can get burned or cut or knocked over or fall on a wet floor or something. So that's pretty much the first thing that we go over. And then from there, I try to create a connection. We talk about the path of food and how food leaves a farm and the energy that it takes to get it from the farmer to my back door, how we process it, and how that process takes place moving forward, going to a plate. And as you begin to explain that process, it creates a vivid picture for any kid that's ever been to the grocery store, because the channel is pretty much the same. I mean, there isn't a grocer that doesn't buy food from some farm somewhere. And most kids haven't sat down and taken a lot of thought to the process between physically buying food and why their parents are buying what they buy. But the connection is somehow made. And then we begin to talk about the things that fascinate them. And I don't try to do as much instructing as I try to ask a lot of questions so that they become engaged as we start to go through answering some of their questions. And it forces them to think about things that they haven't had to think about, or get answers for questions that they didn't quite know how to ask in terms of cooking and things that relate to the difference between cooking every day versus what they see on television.
Got it. So we are going to take a quick break. We are in studio with Chef Eric Williams and Chef Joey Shore, visiting our little studio from Chicago. When we come back, I want to hear a little bit about some new projects and talk a little bit more about the Chicago food scene. So hang tight. You have me now. Hello.
This one's called Morning by Tom Cruise on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Cooking
issues! Who am I fooling? This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die!
It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, we are back in studio. You're listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and we are sitting down with a couple of our friends from Chi-Town, Chef Eric Williams and Zoe Shore. So I want to hear a little bit, like, what's been going on in the food scene in Chicago. Where are you guys kind of eating, you know, late night, early morning, or looking for a little bit of inspiration? What's kind of trending in that neck of the woods?
Just for late night or just in general?
Whatever jumps out at you.
Got you. I mean, there are a lot of great restaurants in Chicago right now. And the last year, I think, has shown a lot of great openings. Ada Street just being one of them.
Hopefully. Obviously.
You know, some of my favorite dining spots right now. Bolena is an Italian concept that Boca opened up last year, right around the same time we opened. That's really just great, great, great food.
Also, the Bristol happens.
Eric's
to be.
Like, I never leave the restaurant. I don't eat anywhere.
It's actually run by the same chef, and Zoe and I didn't have any idea that we both had an admiration for the same chef, and so I was explaining to her a little bit about Chris Pendel's background and the fact that he's really a straightforward chef doing some really, really amazing stuff and just trying to keep it all simple. I think the trends that are really forming in Chicago are legitimately people going back to the roots. I've seen more bone marrow on menus than I've seen in a long time. And a lot of bistro style cooking and restaurants that want to get closer to wine bar concepts and pizzerias are coming back around. And even a lot of those ingredients are showing up again in fine dining menus. So I think the real trend is kind of stepping away from molecular cuisine and going back to the roots. At Next, you know, some would say one of their most successful menus was their ode to cooking in our past. And it's been, you know, a real treat to see some of those ingredients and some of those cooking styles come back around.
Nice. Now, Zoe, you're like newer to the Chicago area. I mean, how was the reception? I mean, would you compare maybe the scene, I guess, if you will, from your time out in California?
Moving to Chicago has been great. And, you know, again, lucky enough to be working for Michael Cornick, who already has, you know, a great reputation in the city that I got to feed off of, as opposed to being just brand new and trying to make it break into the city on my own. I've really loved my transition to Chicago. The weather's not as good as Los Angeles, but I think the food scene in a lot of ways is developed in a way that I prefer personally. Okay. I think what Chef Williams is talking about, I think simplicity, rusticity, these are things that are really highly valued in Chicago. In Los Angeles, it's a little bit fancier.
Yeah.
I'm not that fancy.
I'm like, oh, if I'm in Chicago, I'm like, I'm at the Wiener Circle eating a hot dog.
There you go. I haven't quite made it to the Wiener Circle yet. Like,
give me some waffle fries. what about beverage-wise? I know in New York we're seeing tons of kind of interesting cocktail, a real focus on, you know, bartenders transitioning into almost more of a chef role, really creating their own tinctures and syrups and infusions. But also a real exploding craft beer movement. Tons of amazing brewers here in New York, a real focus on looking at the regional beer economy. I mean, what are you guys drinking?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of local beer, a lot of local spirits in Chicago. And the cocktail scene, I mean, is a lot like what you're talking about. Our bartenders, Ada Street, are very involved. They create the menu themselves and you know, they get direct feedback from their guests and they see what people want to be drinking. Los Angeles is, you know, it's a little bit more fresh juice, muddled fruits, a little bit of a fresher approach, as opposed to, I feel like Chicago is more tinctures. It's making your own bitters. It's a little bit of a darker spirits-based cocktail
kind of
focus.
Booze. Yeah.
You know, and one of my favorite places in Los Angeles to get cocktails is the Hungry Cat, where they, you know, juice everything fresh right in front of you and everything's done to order. And I think that there's a good balance of that and what you're talking about in Chicago, a little bit of in between.
Yeah. How about you, Eric? Do you have a favorite drinking joint?
I must say, if I had to pick a place that I would have beer, it would probably be one of our own concepts, and it would definitely be DMK. And it has part to do with the fact that I've watched how it's developed and it's from its infancy and the time and dedication that the group has put into their beer list and really being committed to serving craft beers. There are a lot of great places in Chicago, but you know, it's kind of hard sometimes to leave your own home when you got everything you need. So
yeah, I feel that.
I would have to say at the forefront of my mind, my first choice is always to go to DMK when I'm thinking drinking beers. In terms of drinking wine, drinking in general, you know, we have access to so much in the restaurant. It just makes it difficult sometimes for me to go somewhere else unless I'm like meeting a friend or something. And usually they kind of select the place.
Sure.
I spend a good amount of time in the restaurant working on menus and things of this sort. And we've got an amazing wine list. So I'm usually drinking wine more than I am cocktails. And, you know, not to sound like a nerd, but the reality is there's so much wine to take advantage of. I'm usually trying to, you know, school my way through it.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm mostly just picking your brain because the Heritage Radio Network's gonna be taking a little trip out to Chicago later in April. I think we're gonna do a little meet and greet at Monk's Pub, like a beer and cheese situation. So hopefully we'll get to see you guys there.
Well, we would love to host you at MK for sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure Zoe would take care of you at 8th Street.
I'm gonna see you in a couple months, guys.
Cool, awesome.
I'll be with my posse of like.
You can't bring one large enough, let me tell you.
So we have a little bit of time left, and I wanted to touch on, Eric, you have a new project, a barbecue project in the works. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's smoking. Wah, wah.
we're in conjunction with MK and the DMK group, I'll be working on a barbecue project, and it's really in the brainchild stage. It's in its infancy, so we're trying to figure out exactly what it's going to look like and exactly what it's going to be. The only thing I can really tell you is it's going to be delicious, and it almost sounds like a cliche to say that a restaurant's going to be delicious, but there's a lot of stuff out there that I don't personally feel is great, and you know, the reality is a lot of chefs have really done what they've done because of the lack thereof. Not all the stuff that we cook is because we woke up some morning and said, I'm going to make the best of this. We ate it somewhere.
Right.
Or it could have been at home and said, I'm going to keep working on this until I perfect it. And people kind of or it kind of creates a draw based on, you know, our desire, our passion to really make something great. So what I can tell you is we're really passionate about barbecue, and we're definitely going to do everything we can to seek out every single person in Chicago that's also passionate about barbecue. It's definitely going to have a lot of pork involved. And for those that would say, oh, well, that's got to be pretty obvious. I mean, there's so many other things that can be barbecued from chicken to brisket. But I think our focus is going to start with ribs. And rib tips and kind of expand from that center. We're definitely going to try to do some things that feel seasonal to us. And though it's going to be barbecue, it won't necessarily be 100% authentic. We're going to pull some sides. If I go to the farmer's market and find something and I can figure out a way to smoke it, then there's a good chance it's going to be on a plate and available to you. And if it blows my mind, I'm going to do everything I can to blow those diners' minds. And that's what it's about. And that's what barbecue has meant to me my entire life. You know, we start with ribs in our family. But anything from a pineapple to squash to asparagus could end up on that grill while those coals are still hot.
Sure.
Right. So and I think we're going to have a chance to do some really creative things on a small scale and really, you know, push the barbecue movement in Chicago. So
that's awesome. And it reminded me like the Scottish chip shops where for $2 they'll deep fry anything you want.
Yeah.
You just come in, we'll smoke it. $3. Yeah. I would say like the craziest barbecue I ever had, I spent a little time in Italy and I was with this Australian woman who would barbecue bananas in the skin and then split them open and stuff bittersweet chocolate inside.
Oh my
And that
God.
Was like, I'd never seen anything like that.
That should go on the menu.
Yeah, I think I might
steal that.
I might need to take a note.
It's yours. Well, we are just about out of time, and I know you guys got to get stretched out. You got a long day of eating through New York City.
Absolutely.
Which I don't envy. No, I do envy. It sounds awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to Whole Foods, our sponsor. You've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned for lots more of the latest and greatest. Tune in at www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.